You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his latest book called Collaborator Parish, former NYPD and LAPD Commissioner William Branton reveals his playbook for reaching across boundaries in a networked world where the utilization of collaboration-enhancing technology is expanding rapidly. He wrote it with Zachary Tooman of the Harvard Kennedy School, and it's published by Crown Business, and I'm very pleased to welcome William Branton back to our show today.
It's great to be back after many years.
Now, in 2009, in the intervening years, Queen Elizabeth II bestowed the honorary title of Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, the CBE, on you. So does that mean I have to address you as Sir William?
No, but it does get me better tables at restaurants in London. I now understand what all those letters are behind British names. So CBE has some weight.
And really, you do. Can you wear a little ribbon?
So actually, it's pretty ostentatious, so you can't wear it on the lapel of your coat, unfortunately. Pretty large.
The book is a collaboration with Zachary Tooman of the Harvard Kennedy School. How did this partnership come about?
Actually, the inspiration for the book is that of Zach. Zach is a senior researcher at Harvard. We have collaborated on a couple of case studies. We've known each other for many years when he was director of security for the New York City school system. I did a consultancy with him after I had left as police commissioner. And we have stayed in touch through the years. It was his idea that to have this book, and he saw in my experiences in New York, Boston, and L.A., which he was very familiar with, that the eight steps that are the heart of the book to collaboration, that's what I had practiced. So when he presented the idea, it resonated, and here we are a year and a half later after a lot of work. It's a great book.
Well, how should we interpret the word collaborate in your context? The thesaurus suggests that it means both cooperation and submission.
Well, if you think of it, I think only recently have we, recently in the last generation, seen collaboration in the idea of cooperation. The World War II use of it was, in fact, submission, that collaborators were collaborating with the Nazis or the Japanese.
And we see some of that in Washington today, where some people would say that if you concede on any ground, you're a collaborator with the enemy.
Well, the irony, the problem, as I would look at Washington and as you look at this book, is the problem in Washington today is that they no longer collaborate, that the whole idea of politics is to build some degree of consensus. Instead, they have totally turned the world upside down there. And it's ironic that Congress, with 9% approval ratings, the worst collaborators since the Tower of Babel. And so I would hope they'd all read this book. Maybe we'd get the country back on track again.
And maybe they should look at the title, Collaborate or Perish. Are the stakes really that high?
They really are that high, that if you think of it, in today's world, the incredible ways in which people network with each other that 10, 15 years ago were non-existent, the platforms. In the book, we talk about finding a clearing or a platform. And today, people can do it through Twitter. They can do it through blogs. An example, when my first book came out in the 90s, a traditional book, I did a book tour like this, did some radio, did some television. But that was before Twitter, that was before blogs, that was before websites. We now have a website, we have a Twitter, we have a blog to keep audiences engaged with the book.
And does that also work with police departments? I remember during the Manson years, one of the explanations for his not being arrested earlier was that the LAPD and the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office didn't communicate, and they were right next to each other.
Exactly. In the book, my contribution, I speak to the Boston, New York, and particularly the more recent LAPD experience, in which my success and the success of the LAPD and hopefully the success of that city in terms of being a much safer city with much improved race relations was around the idea that I took into that city in 2002, the idea that to succeed, you're going to have to collaborate, because I saw that my predecessors for 40 years did not collaborate. The thin blue line that Bill Parker was so famous for in the LAPD of the 1960s, Joe Friday Dragnet, was really about the idea of we the police, leave us alone and we'll take care of business. And they took care of business in terms of taking on the black community, and you had 40 years of racial animosity out there.
Well, we also saw a lack of collaboration between the FBI and the CIA and the
NSA.
That's
a great point in terms of the 9/11 Commission, the idea that they, by law, were precluded from sharing information. I serve as the vice chairman of the Homeland Security Advisory Council to Secretary Napolitano, and she and Homeland Security are all about collaboration, that they could not survive without it, the exchange, open exchange of information.
When you were named New York City Transit Police Chief in 1990, the main problem facing the MTA was fare beating. How had the transit police previously tried to solve the problem?
They solved the problem, or tried to, in a very inefficient way. In that
you said it was like they were working inside a silo.
They were effectively, they didn't want, most of the cops were drafted into the transit police. They all wanted to be city police, but they couldn't get on the city police because they were drafted in transit. They hated the idea of working for the transit authority, and the transit authority, all they were concerned about was their money. So they were assigned to stand at turnstiles and guard the turnstiles, keep protect them from vandalism, and ensure that people paid the fare. And the problem with that was there were 700 turnstile arrays in the city's 400-some-odd stations, and there were at any given time only about 300 to 400 police on duty, so that meant that half of the turnstiles were not covered. So you effectively had a big hole in your security net. We developed, and I write about this in the book, and Malcolm Gladwell in his book, Tipping Point, he feels that some of the inspiration for that book was this transit police experience of how we dealt with fare evasion. And in the book, I talk about that we developed ability for officers to collaborate with each other, work in teams, work with the transit authority, work with the district attorney's offices, something that had not been done before. And the success in transit was so profound, with crime going down by double digit, while the city was going down by single digit, attracted Rudy Giuliani to me, and that's how I ultimately became the police commissioner in 1994.
In a new book called The City That Became Safe, Professor Franklin Zimmering, a Berkeley law criminologist, argues that what happened in New York wasn't a reflection of a national pattern, as many suggest, but actually was the singular achievement of you and Ray Kelly, who followed you as police commissioner. You must have been very pleased when you heard that.
Very pleased with the compliment and some of the professor's findings. I would challenge, though, some of the findings because I was here. I lived them. I helped to create them with a lot of very smart people. And police should be credited with being the most significant component of the turnaround, but it was the larger collaboration, political leadership. In fact, in the book, the central theme of this book, Collaborative Parish, the eight essential elements of collaboration. All eight were in play in 1994 with Mayor Giuliani, but one of them fell apart, and that was number seven, that stay in the political headlights. Well, he and I had a falling out, and the collaboration collapsed, and I was gone.
Well, he suggested that you resigned, and you suggested that you were pushed out. It was simply because he wanted credit, you told me, the last time you were on the show, credit for things that the police department had developed.
Right, and this goes into the idea that what happened in New York in the 90s was the result of an incredible collaboration. And I speak to that in this book also, Zach and I, in discussing New York. And the problem was the sharing of the credit. It has to be something in it for everybody.
So what did you learn from that experience about navigating politics?
The next initiative that I was engaged in the public sector was Los Angeles. And Los Angeles, in many respects, was a much more significant success story than New York. I'm certainly New York, and I think in general more widely known for the New York experience, but the more successful experience was Los Angeles.
But doesn't Los Angeles still have serious problems with gangbangers?
They do, but overall gang crime is down by over 60%. Race relations, the L.A. Times talked about during my time at LAPD that the corner had been turned on race relations, something that did not happen here in New York in the 90s, so that L.A. was all eight elements of the collaboration that Zach Tuman and I write about were in play in Los Angeles, so the success was even more significant.
Race relations have frayed to some degree because of a certain police policy that has been instituted more recently, the stop and frisk policy. Do you see that as an extension of what you had done earlier, the broken windows theory, or is this something that you would not have allowed?
Stop and frisk is an essential component of American policing. You have to have it,
But an awful lot of innocent people have been stopped again and again and again.
Well, the debate in the city, the unresolved debate, and it's a very contentious one that everybody's in their corners, if you will, slugging it out, is about this issue. But being quite frank with you, back in the subways, we engaged in a lot of it. It stopped question and frisk. It actually has three elements. In Los Angeles, we have proportionally the same amount of stop, question, and frisk that they have in New York, with many less concerns or questions about it. So the unresolved issue, I think, here is why is there in this city, more so than any place else in America, a practice that is widely used in every city in this country? Why is there so much sensitivity to it here? I think part of it is the fact that crime has gone down so dramatically here, from 700,000 reported in 1990 to this year, about 105,000. Particularly in the minority communities, the sense is that, well, with so much less crime, should there be a lot less police interaction with us in terms of stop and frisk? And that is the unresolved question.
And people see it as racial profiling. And
which it is not.
Well, but how do cops get past that?
In terms of, let me speak to that, because I strongly disagree with the idea that this is racial profiling. In a city that has 23% African-American population, African-Americans in this city are involved in 80% of the shootings and shooting victims, so that you have to basically put it into context that where 80% of the shootings and murders are occurring in that community, naturally that's where you're going to put police attention. And so we need to take all of this into context. Is it racial profiling when, by reducing crime as dramatically we have in New York City, the principal beneficiaries of that reduced crime are minorities, African Americans and Latinos? Just think of it, the fact that this year there will be 1,500 fewer people murdered in New York City. 80% of those would have been African American young men, and 80% of those going to jail for those murders would have been African-American young men. So every one you prevent, you save two lives.
You've called George Kelling, who developed the broken window theory, your intellectual mentor. What did you get from him?
George is a mentor, a close friend. He and I are actually working on a book about the American crime experience. George is an academic researcher who walks the walk and talks the talk. He goes into cities. He walks neighborhoods. He was extraordinarily helpful in the transit police, brought me to the transit police, actually, when he was consulting there, advised me in every one of my other departments, and he was working very closely with me, collaborating with me in Los Angeles on the successful turnaround there. He's probably one of the smartest people in the country on this business.
And he and you argue that broken windows theory empowers a community?
It really does, because the idea is the concept of community policing is first and foremost about partnership. Partnership is another term for collaboration. And again, Zach Tuman, when he came to me with the idea for this book, he was very aware of my embrace of community policing and partnership, in which police work with the community to identify what are your priorities, where can we find common ground, a platform to stand on, what's in it for all of us. Each, you know, community wants safer streets, cops want to feel that they're making them safer, and that the effort of community policing is collaboration in action, if you will.
My guest is William Bratton, who, with Zachary Tuman, has written Collaborate or Perish, Reaching Across Boundaries in a Networked World. It is published by Crown Business. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with William Bratton, who is currently chairman of Kroll, a business actually owned by Allegrity,
Altegrity. That's the holding company that owns it. Kroll's the largest risk management security firm in the world, actually. I'm very pleased to be chairman of it.
He is co-author with Zachary Tuman, who is a special assistant to the director and faculty chair of Harvard Kennedy School's Science, Technology, and Public Policy program.
That's quite a title, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to go through all of the cities you've been police commissioner. Their book is called Collaborate or Perish, Reaching Across Boundaries in a Networked World. It is published by Crown Business, which suggests that the business community is your ideal reading audience for this, or would
actually,
you...
Actually, the strength of this book, and that's a great question, it's you'll probably find it in the management section of the business section of most bookstores, but it's about leadership, it's about management, it's about a system that not only in the business world that I'm now in, but also in the public sector where I spent most of my life, it reaches across all of those boundaries, business, public sector, law enforcement, politics. It's a book for all of those areas.
And a lot of it has to do with the use of the new technologies in dealing with the problems of the day. Let's talk about CompStat. Prior to the adoption of CompStat, how were crimes mapped in the city?
Oftentimes they were not. They were reported, but as far as mapping them as to tell you where to put your police officers, that was not being done. The priorities of the New York City Police Department in the 70s and 80s were largely to stay out of trouble, anti-corruption. And it was not a risk-taking police department. In the 90s, that began to change, and we became much more focused on that we can do something about crime. How do we do it? And CompStat was the evolutionary process that was developed during that time.
Well, in the movies, people used to put stick pins in certain neighborhoods.
And I was doing that in the 1970s. When I brought to New York in the 90s, I was doing the 70s in Boston, but it took me 20 years to get into a position to get it in a much larger environment.
So what is CompStat? And didn't you encounter some resistance when you tried to implement it at the NYPD?
Let me speak to CompStat. In the book Collaborative Perish, we talk about the eight essential elements of collaboration. And one of them is a common platform in which people can gather, a platform or clearing, where they can share ideas, where they have transparency. CompStat, in the very large 38,000-person NYPD, was that platform. Twice a week, the leadership of the department, the rank and file, from all over the city, came together, detectives uniform, to headquarters where we had large maps, we had large statistical analysis, in which we, in a very transparent way, a very inclusive way, talked about crime. Where's it happening? Who's committing it, and what are we, the police, doing about it? And one of the things we were able to do about it was knowing when it was occurring, who was doing it. We were able to put our police into those neighborhoods looking for those individuals. And CompStat literally saved the city. It's widely adopted in policing around the world now. And Zach Tooman, when he created the idea for this book, looked at CompStat as literally a key component of collaboration for the first time in the NYPD, where everybody was talking to everybody else.
You also were demanding from the police force that they deliver a 10% annual reduction. Isn't that an invitation to people to distort the figures?
Two responses to that. Once again, in the book, The Eight Steps, one of the steps is right-size the problem. Well, the problem of crime was huge, but a 10% reduction even shocked those that it was presented to in 1994, because the previous year they had a reduction of 1% or 2%. But we felt it was doable, and we got 12%. The next year we got 15%. All during that time and continuing into L.A., I have an expression, don't use sharp pencils. We want honest crime reports, because that tells us where to put the police. And you're going to be measured not so much by crime reduction or crime increase, but what are you doing about it? What are the ideas you're creating? And the NYPD of then and today have extensive, and now the LAPD, auditing systems to ferret out anybody who would be foolish enough to take that risk. And in any event, you would have to skew thousands of police reports to have even a 1% impact on overall crime rates.
Well, when you came here, you went after squeegee guys. Now we're hearing about police using drones to help in their mapping and to fight crime. That seems like a big leap, and something that makes some people uncomfortable. This ending the squeegee men didn't make some people uncomfortable as well.
Getting rid of the squeegee men was very important, because they were a symbol of police not addressing issues that were causing fear and concern among the public about the disorder and the decay of the city. The technology evolution and revolutions that have occurred since the 1990s, we didn't have BlackBerries back then, we didn't have cell phones, and has been phenomenal. drones are, particularly being utilized by the military, are being tested by police. They would be probably problematic in a city as densely populated as New York, with all the air traffic that goes over every part of the city. In Los Angeles, we have 20 helicopters at any given time. There are three of them in the air. You cannot police Los Angeles without those helicopters. A logical extension of that to save on cost would be to actually have drones up in the air that don't require having people sitting in the device. So I think you're going to see, as part of the continuing evolution, it's cost-effective. It is a good use of technology, and it is part of the way the world is going.
Talk about cost-effectiveness makes me think about the recent demands for cutbacks on public employee pensions and unions that involve the police. What impact has that had on morale and recruitment?
Well, I think, unfortunately, in some areas, the pension benefits that police, firefighters, other employees, particularly police and firefighters, receive in these new economically stressed times, to many people seem to be overly generous. I would point out they're usually won through collective bargaining. They are done in the light of day, if you will. And but times have changed, and going forward is quite clearly an effort on the part of many political leaders to, for future generations of government employees, to reduce benefits. That's something that would have to be negotiated. The morale impact is those efforts being made to reduce pension benefits that have already fairly been won through collective bargaining, and which people are entitled to, whether you like it or not.
Well, this is a collaboration issue, isn't it?
It really is. The idea of, if you think of it, labor negotiations are collaboration. The idea of coming to some degree of consensus. Politics in this country used to be about collaboration and consensus that for the last few years we've been experiencing the total breakdown of that framework, and which is really impacting on certainly trying to address our economic concerns.
Well, how do you address people who say to you that if I collaborate with this other person, I'm really going against my ideals? I am betraying the people who voted for me for sticking up for a certain idea that I promised to deliver to them.
Isn't that, though, the art of politics, the idea of attempting to, in our country, that a majority rule, but everybody having the opportunity to participate in the process, and recognizing that at some point in time, everybody's going to have to give something. And in collaboration, the idea is oftentimes everybody gives up something, but there's something in it for everybody also for a successful collaboration.
My guest is William Bratton, who has written with Harvard's Zachary Tooman, Collaborate or Perish, Reaching Across Boundaries in a Networked World. It is published by Crown Business. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Some of your advice seems fairly obvious. Get the right people involved. Are people naturally inclined to work alone? There was an article in the Times just recently about how offices now are eliminating private rooms and everybody is sitting together. And I have to tell you, there are times when that would cause me real problems in working with my staff.
Thank you for bringing that article up. It was in this week's In Review section of the New York Times. It was written by Susan Cain, and it was entitled Collaboration. It was entitled The Rise of the New Group
Groupthink.
Groupthink. And she's the subtitle, Collaboration is In, but it may not be conducive to creativity. I take great exception with the major thrust of her article, which was the idea that some of the best thinking goes on when people have private time to themselves, and that the new teamwork and collaborative efforts work against that. Well, the best thinking does oftentimes work. I know some of mine does when I have quiet time to myself. But is that thinking of any value unless you can then take it to the group and have collaboration to actually make it impactful? Einstein's theory of relativity, if you never shared it with anybody, of what value would it have been? So the idea that they devoted two full pages in the Sunday New York Times to that theory, it didn't take it to the next step. Sure, give people privacy. I like having a private office, being quite frank with you, but I also like bringing people into that office. And if you think of Compstat was about, instead of sitting on the 14th floor of police headquarters by myself, going down to the 6th floor and having 300 other NYPD people around me to share their ideas. I didn't claim to have all the ideas.
Although that also can lead to the problem of having so many meetings that you're not doing anything other than sharing ideas all the time.
Well, isn't that the constant
balance? As soon as I get out of this meeting, I'm actually going to do something.
Well, look at me. As soon as I get out of here, I'll be looking at my email, so we become overwhelmed by the new platform that we all gather around, and that's whether it's email or the blogs or the Twitters.
One reviewer wrote about this book, the Kirkus reviewer, that although you present a series of highly informative and wide-ranging examples showing the rapidly expanding impact of collaboration-enhancing technology, they're also frequently unsettling because they range from just right-sizing problems to coercing participation if it comes to that. And they say that might be repressive given the immense new powers of top-down control that come with collaboration as your book defines it.
Isn't there a degree of coercion in just about everything we do in our lives? We have laws. We have rules and regulations. In the police department, I would order people to come to CompStat. So there was a degree of coercion. But in that,
did they not want to come?
Many did not want to because they had to get up early to get there by 7 a.m. Many people don't like the idea of being called to account for what are you doing about this problem or having their problems identified. Life is full of give and take. And so I would quarrel with that opinion about the book. It is an element, certainly, of collaboration, of once again, everybody giving up something for the greater good. But also we emphasize the importance of finding, for that collaboration to work, what's in it for everybody that's being asked to collaborate.
Well, what makes a useful platform for collaboration?
It can be anything. In the NYPD, the platform was CompStat. That was the engine that drove the NYPD. It can be that idea of finding, again, going back to the point, what's in it for me as a community member to be seen as working with the police? Well, hopefully it's a safer community for you and your family and your friends. And the platforms vary from task to task, problem to problem. But what is important is to find that clearing, that place where people can gather together to exchange ideas. It might be around the coffee machine at the office.
Well, it's you point out that crisis often creates the best opportunity for collaboration, and that was something that was mentioned as we went through this major economic crisis. But what we saw instead was the Democrats saying this is a good time to come up with solutions because of this crisis. The Republicans saying the same thing and absolutely not meeting anywhere near the middle.
I'm a great believer in that the use of crises, and if you don't have one, create one. In both the NYPD and LAPD experience, by way of example, both departments, I had to create a crisis of confidence in their capabilities, that both of them were pretty smug about. NYPD, we're the largest. LAPD, we're one of the most storied police departments in history. But what I had to basically do was basically take the clothes off the emperor, and you have no clothes. Crime is going up. The public is fearful. Why do you think you're doing such a good job when what you were created for, you're failing at?
Well, in the case of L.A., it was Police Commissioner Parker. With the FBI, it was J. Edgar Hoover. We also had these cults of personality that obscured what was really going on.
Exactly. And basically, Parker at the LAPD, Hoover at the FBI, are clear examples of failure to collaborate, the idea, gather information, not share it, be exclusive, not be transparent, in some respects almost create a paranoia or a fear to rule by fear.
As the chairman of Kroll, I mentioned this earlier, that it's a private investigative and security firm. Aren't you leading the probe into the campus police at UC Davis over the November 18th pepper spray incident?
That's correct. That Kroll is a security investigative firm that does due diligence. We do forensics. We do cybersecurity. I was asked, myself and my company, Kroll, to come in and assist the University of California in their investigation and review of the pepper spray incident that was widely broadcast around the world. And we are currently coming to closure on that investigation.
Well, there was a sense with all of the occupiers that there was a big culture gap between police and the protesters. And some people wondered why that would be.
Well, actually, if you think of it, that police being as impacted as anybody in this current economic downturn, that the numbers of police in the United States are declining through actual layoffs, through numbers not being hired, that we probably have as few police as we had at the beginning of the 1990s now because of that. So police are being impacted, pension discussions, reduction in pension benefits, inability to get pay raises. But police in our society are required to, in some respects, show an objectivity in dealing with these issues. And there's no denying that some actions of some police officers were inappropriate, several here in New York, certainly University of California was of great concern.
Oakland was another.
Oakland was another area. Some of that also, though, is, and as the investigations are going forward, may come about because of failure to collaborate between leadership, police, administrations, and I think that's probably what we'll find occurred in the sense of what is the sense of mission, what are the limits, what are the rules, and what was the common platform to come together to discuss these issues?
Well, in speaking to police officers at the time, I got a sense that there was a big gap within the department between the regular people on patrol and the guys who walk around with white shirts, who they seem to have a little bit of contempt for. And they said, well, don't ask me. Ask that guy. He's the one who's come up with this crazy order.
That's policing. Cops are great at griping.
It's like me complaining about my boss.
I love the profession. I was formerly part of for 40 years, and I love cops, but I also am very cognizant of cops, and we're very good at griping and groaning.
But who are those guys with the white shirts? And
those
how do
guys
they
with
them?
The white shirts are people who study very hard to be promoted, who want to take the risk of leadership and the risk of being standing out there in a white shirt instead of a blue shirt where you stand out very clearly. No, all credit to the leadership because they work very hard to get in those positions, and the risks they take are very significant in terms of those leadership positions.
William Bratton has been the leader of a number of police departments in Boston, New York, Los Angeles, and he has collaborated with Zachary Tooman of Harvard Business School on a book called Collaborate or Perish, Reaching Across Boundaries in a Networked World. It's published by Crown Business. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's great being here with you. Thank you.